freedom. My name is M1. I'm half of the legendary Tell It Like It Is, Everything Is Political rap duo Dead Prez. And this is WPFW, Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
We would never forget our land or our houses and our homes in Palestine. And I would never forget the taste and the smell and the shape of the oranges from Palestine. And you could say whatever you want, that I'm crazy or whatever you want, but I insist that these oranges are from Palestine.
A survivor of the Palestinian Nakba or catastrophe visits D.C. And economist Julian Malvo asks, are African Americans better off after the Obama presidency?
We fall in love as a people with symbol, but not substance. There have been too many opportunities for him to do substance that he's failed to do. Now, he has not lied to anybody. He never said he was going to be a black president. At the same time, the fact that he never talks about black unemployment, it's almost like he's allergic to the word black, like his lips might curl up and go in another direction if he says black.
All that and much more coming up.
And welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital on 89.3 WPFW, your Pacifica station for justice and jazz and so much more. I'm Esther Rivera. Well, a jam-packed show for you today. Economist and author Julianne Malvo will be here with her new book that asks if African Americans are better off after the Obama presidency. And we'll hear from 86-year-old Mariam Fatala, who was forced to flee her village in 1948 when she was just 18 years old and has spent the last 68 years living in a crowded refugee camp in Lebanon. Now she is traveling around the United States until June on what is called the North American Nakba Tour. Nakba means in English the catastrophe, and this is the word Palestinians use to describe the genocide and mass displacement that occurred in 1948 when they were forced from their homes and land during the founding of the State of Israel. It's April 29th, just ahead of May 1st, May Day, International Workers' Day, which will mark this show's second anniversary. So as always, power to the people. We have a lot for you coming up, starting with our headlines. As Verizon workers enter the third week of their strike, they and their supporters picketed the L Street Verizon Wireless store in downtown D.C. yesterday. The union, the Communication Workers of America, is receiving donations to support the striking workers. The CWA issued a statement yesterday saying that at negotiating sessions in Westchester and Philadelphia, executives at Verizon refused to back off proposals that would hurt working families and destroy middle-class jobs, including shipping jobs overseas and outsourcing work. And there's a huge labor uprising in France over proposed reforms that workers say will compromise their hard-won worker protections. Police used tear gas against protesters in Paris and four other cities, and they clashed with protesters using the tear gas while young people threw bottles and stones. 124 people were arrested nationwide. And thousands of people marched in Mexico City this week to mark 19 months since the disappearance of 43 students in the southern state of Guerrero. The protest came after an international panel of experts released its final report, casting doubt on the Mexican government's account of what happened to the students and accusing the government of stonewalling and retaliating against investigators. And as we mentioned, Sunday is May Day, International Workers' Day, and Sunday marks the sixth month anniversary of the death of Alonzo Smith, a teacher, at the hands of so-called special police officers here in Southeast Washington. To show that Alonzo Smith is missed but never forgotten, there will be a march led by Beverly Smith, his mother, and other members of Pan-African Community Action starting at 3 p.m. at Marbury Plaza, 2300 Good Hope Road in Southeast, and ending at the 7th District Station, 2455 Alabama Avenue Southeast. Beverly Smith told On the Ground that 6 months later, she has received little information about her son's death in police custody.
May 1st, Sunday, will mark 6 months since my son has been killed by two special police officers in Marbury Plaza on Good Hope Road Southeast on November the 1st of last year. As of to date, the names of the special police officer has not been released. There has been no arrest. My son's case has been in the hands of the grand jury since December of last year. They haven't even told me when the grand jury is going to convene. So I don't even know if they have convened already. So they're not giving out any information. The only thing they're telling me and my lawyers is that the case is still under investigation. For one, I would like the community to come out and to support me. And also in a way that the community can support, my son has an online petition. And this petition is going to be sent to the United Nations and is going to be sent to also the mayor and Department of Justice. We are requesting demanding an independent investigation. And also my son has a go-to Fummy page. So if everyone can go there and to contribute, anything that you can would be well appreciated. Thank you.
Again, that rally and march for Alonzo Smith begins this Sunday at 3 p.m. at 2300 Good Hope Road in Southeast. There are also other May Day activities for this weekend. Tomorrow there will be a May Day workshops, panel, and discussions at La Casa, 3166 Mount Pleasant Avenue Northwest in D.C., 10:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m., sponsored in part by D.C. Labor for Peace and Justice and IWW Southern Speaking Tour. On Sunday, there will be a march for May Day for workers beginning at 2 p.m. at Malcolm X Park, 16th Street and Euclid Street Northwest, and marching to the White House by 3 p.m. This is a call upon all workers, students, and soldiers to march for May Day. For more information, visit the Facebook event page under D.C. May Day March. Finally, in our culture and media moment, the D.C. Labor Film Fest kicks off tonight at the AFI Silver Theater in Silver Spring with Trumbo, about the successful screenwriter Dalton Trumbo, who was targeted during the McCarthy period and House Un-American Activity Committee's Communist Witch Hunt. The documentary portrait of blacklisted Hollywood screenwriter was written by his son, Christopher, and directed by Peter Askin. Like their previous collaboration, the off-Broadway play Trumbo, Red, White, and Blacklisted, the film relies heavily on the letters Trumbo wrote during the 1950s, read by noted actors Michael Douglas, Joan Allen, Donald Sutherland, Liam Neeson, and Paul Giamatti. Organized and presented by the Metropolitan Washington Council of the AFL-CIO, the Debs Jones Douglas Institute, and the AFI Silver, the 16th Annual DC Labor Film Fest features a wide selection of films about work, workers, and workers' issues, including Concussion, about head injuries in the NFL, starring Will Smith. For more information, go to dclabor.org. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, an elderly Palestinian woman visits D.C. to tell her story of being forced from her homeland 68 years ago and her desire to return. Stay with us. Palestinian woman, Maryam Fatala, was forced to flee her village in 1948 when she was just 18 years old and has spent the past 48 years living in a refugee camp in Lebanon. Now 86 years old, she's traveling around the United States until June on what is called the North American Nakba Tour. Nakba means in English, the catastrophe. And this is the word Palestinians use to describe the genocide and mass displacement that occurred in 1948 when they were forced from their homes and land during the founding of the State of Israel. On Monday night, Maryam and Amina Ashkar, the granddaughter and great-granddaughter of other Nakba survivors, made the D.C. stop of their tour at the Potter's House, located in the Adams Morgan neighborhood of D.C. The following clip begins with Amina Ashkar, who, like the elder, also lives in a stateless refugee lives as a stateless refugee in Lebanon and has never been allowed to visit Palestine after her Mariam Fatala tells her story of the Nakba in Arabic and is translated by Amina.
I'm going to start with a small briefing about the Nakba. What is the Nakba to the people who do not actually know? First of all, the word Nakba means the catastrophe in English. And the point is that the Israelis, or the, let's, we have guys to know two things. First of all, I do not use the word Israel. So I tend to use occupied Palestine or Palestinian occupied Palestinian territories. We do not use Israel. And the second thing, while telling the story of some of the massacres that happened, there was no Israel back then. It was not. So the gangs that did the massacres were European Jews. And I'm going to use this term so you guys have to know that, because we had no Israel before 1948. So they wanted to establish this entity on our land. So what they basically did is they performed all kinds of genocides and atrocities all around Palestine so that people, to fright people and to scare them away from Palestine. So that's why how the refugee crisis started as Palestinians. So what happened, first of all, you should know this in front of you. This is the map of Palestine before the 1948 during the British mandate. And of course we have right here, we have the Mediterranean Sea. And that's the sea that the Palestinians used in order to run away from the massacres. Of course we have here into Lebanon, of course. We have here, you guys have to know, this is Zeeb village. This is the village that Im Akram came originally from, and it is a part of the Akka district. And here we have a settlement. This settlement is Nahariya settlement. Of course, you know, the Jewish migration into Palestine started before the 1948. It actually started during the 1800s. And this settlement was full of Jews. Some of them were Palestinians, some were European Jews, and they were basically living all peacefully together. And there was no any kind of problems until what started to happen in 1948 and the massacres that started to happen. So as you can see, this is Zeeb village, and this is Lebanon. As you can see, it's so close to it. That's why people ran through the Mediterranean into Lebanon. You guys have to know this in order to be able to connect to what Makram was going to say. And what happened is that, as I said, they had these massacres all around these villages. They started with Deir Yassin. Deir Yassin was one of the most important and actually horrible massacres in the year of 1948, and it was so influential that people were afraid. Even before the Jews attacked their villages, they just only heard about what happened in Deir Yassin, and they ran away from Palestine. And of course, they did that because in order to establish their country or entity, they wanted to get rid of the non-Jews, because, as you know, Israel is founded on the Jewish identity. Though we had Jews in Palestine, they are Palestinian Jews, and we were living in harmony, peacefully. There was no kind of problems between each other. But they were minority. So they wanted to get rid as much as they could of Palestinians, of non-Jewish Palestinians. And they used, as I said, the massacres. Of course, and one of the Israeli ambassador, Eliyahu Eleth, once said, he was asked, why don't you want the refugees back into Palestine? So he said, because Israel would commit suicide if it actually allowed the Palestinians or the refugees into Palestine. So as you can see, it is done. Like the decision is taken that they do not want the refugees into Palestine. And these photos you can see in front of you are some of the atrocities, and it's a Deir Yassin massacre actually. Actually I'm talking about it because it had the most influential effect on what happened. This part is taken from Menachem Begin's book. He was of course the head of the Irgun gang that was responsible for this massacre, and he said later, after he became the prime minister of Israel, he said, "The legend in Deir Yassin helped us in particular in the saving of Tabaraya and the conquest of Haifa. All the Jewish forces proceeded to advance through Haifa like a knife through butter. The Arabs," of course he means Palestinians, but he does not use that, "the Arabs began fleeing in panic, shouting, 'Deir Yassin.' Arabs throughout the country were seized by limitless panic and started to flee for their lives. And induced to believe the wild tales of Irgun butchery," of course that's before this mass flight, "soon developed into mandant and uncontrollable stampede. The political and economic significance of this development can hardly be overestimated." So as you can see, it had really big effect on the Palestinians inside Palestine, and they used it in order to scare people out of their land. And that's how the Nakba happened. Of course, Akram is going to talk about how they left their village into Lebanon. So I had to show you some of these photos in order to know what does the word Nakba mean. This is a Nakba. Like, when you see these photos, this is a Nakba. And Akram is going to tell you about how they use the fishing boats in order to flee their lives. And this is actually one of the villages. This photo is for the locals from Zeeb village, and how they used the fishing boats in order to flee through the Mediterranean and into Lebanon, of course. Here, this very photo is for Ain El Hilwi refugee camp. This is how people used to live for a couple of years, like for 5 or 6 years in tents. They used to live in tents. They were forced to leave their lands and houses in order to live in tents. And now we're going to head to the stories that Akram has to tell us about the Nakba.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi
wa barakatuh. So I am from Zeeb village, from district of Akka. We had a very close settlement to us called Naharaya settlement. This settlement used to live inside it Jews. And we were living peacefully together. We had businesses with each other. We used to visit each other. We had no problems with each other until the problems started in the 1948. So people back, the villagers in Zeeb village, used to take to have their vegetables and fruits and deport them into this main city of Akka. And they had to cross or move through the settlement of Naharaya. And once there were three trucks trying to move goods from Zeeb village into Akka, and they had of course to go through Naharaya. And a group of the settlers stopped them. They burned down their trucks, and they killed all the guys that were in these trucks. They were 10, and they killed them all. And then two trucks were following the three previous trucks. They saw the smoke, and then they found out that all of the men were killed. So they went back to the main village and told people, the villagers, what happened. And then when the problems actually started between the settlers in Naharaya and the villagers of Zeeb village. And then it started and also after a couple of days of what happened with the trucks, the settlers attacked the village of Zeeb, and there was the very first house in the village. They attacked it, and they went inside it, killed the husband and the shepherd who used to work for the family. The woman, or the wife of this husband, of the man, was pregnant, and she was afraid for the boy or for the baby in her womb, so she had to hide inside the chimney of the house. She stayed hanging inside the chimney until she heard no more noise, and they left. And then she managed to run away through the forest into other villages of the district of Akka. So people, then, after killing the people inside the first house, these settlers, or these gangs, started to move around the houses in the village, and they started killing people, of course, using axes, because they did not want anyone to know what is happening. And people then started to run away and hide. Of course, the villagers never expected something like that was going to happen, because they were living peacefully since ever with these settlers. So, and they had no weapons. So they tried to defend the village as much as they could after making their taking their kids and their wives into the safe place, which was mainly Lebanon. Of course, they never differentiated between kids or women or elderly people. They just killed using axes and bullets. Of course, people became frightened and ran away, leaving behind them their houses and their lands. And then we had to move into, we moved into Lebanon. At the beginning, we sat in Tyre. It's the closest city to Palestine, Lebanese city to Palestine. And then we moved to Saida after the United Nations came, and they sat for us tents. And we had to live inside tents for a couple of years before things changed. Of course, during the same year, it was so, the winter was so heavy. And it was, we used to be sleeping inside our tents, and the wind came and blew them away. And of course, many children died because of that. And you should know also that every two families used to share one tent. So it was pure agony for us after we were forced to leave our lands. Of course, even after living inside refugee camps, the Israeli forces never left us alone. They started bombing our camp. And once, of course, many people were killed during these bombs or shells. And once they were bombing the camp, and my dad wanted to go and seek like shelter inside the mosque. He was an old man, so he wanted to go. He left his house and was trying to reach the mosque in order to go inside it, because the roofs of the houses were made of tents and of metal, whereas the mosque was made of cement. So that's why the people used to hide inside it. And my dad left the house and wanted to go to the mosque. So my dad, when he was trying to run away to the mosque, he saw a lady. She was lying down. She was basically, she was dead. And the people were trying to move her. And when they held her arm was ripped off, and they in their hands. And that's when her dad saw that, and he got so tired and went to the hospital, and he only stayed alive for 2 hours. He had a trauma, and he died because of that. He had a heart attack because of the horrible scenes and the killed and the dead bodies all over the place. He died because of that. And even before reaching the hospital, he was asking his family not to take him to a hospital that injured people are inside. So he only survived for 2 hours and died, not because of a shell or a bomb, just because of the horrible scenes he saw. So after a while, we had to find something to work and in order to earn living. So my husband Abu Akram started to work for a wealthy man in Beirut as a gardener. And once he went to the market and got some oranges and went back to the house, and we had some guests. So I chopped up some of these oranges and served them to these guests. And Abu Akram ate one piece of the oranges, and then suddenly he started to cry. So the guests asked Abu Akram, "Why are you crying, Abu Akram? Now you were just laughing and nothing was wrong. What just happened?" So after asking him why he's crying, he said, "These oranges are not from Lebanon. These oranges are from Palestine." So they started to mock him and tell him that you're a crazy man. Like, now we're in 1972 and you left Palestine back in 1948. How could you possibly just remember recognize that these oranges are from Palestine? So he said, "We would never forget our land or our houses and our homes in Palestine. And I would never forget the taste and the smell and the shape of the oranges from Palestine. And you could say whatever you want, that I'm crazy or whatever you want, but I insist that these oranges are from Palestine." So at the very next morning, that guest came into the Abu Akram's house holding a newspaper and telling him, "Yesterday we mocked you and laughed at you in your face because you said that the oranges were from Palestine. But now the newspaper are saying that there is a big amount of oranges coming from the occupied land, from the occupied Palestine into Lebanon. And these oranges were actually from the oranges of the Palestinian oranges. I just want to know, how were you able to recognize these oranges after all these years?" So he said that, "I would never forget Palestine. I would never forget my homeland. And these oranges, I would never like, I know their taste and I would never forget them. We wish that we will, someday we're going to go back to our land, to our homes in Palestine, and we live peacefully. And I wish peace surrounds the whole planet. And thank you so much." We just want the right to return, that's all.
If you're just tuning in, you just heard the voices of Mariam Fatala and Amina Ashkar, two Palestinian women who are traveling to dozens of cities in the United States on the North American Nakba tour, designed to educate about the Nakba, which means in English, the catastrophe. And this is the word Palestinians use to describe the genocide and mass displacement that occurred in 1948 when Palestinians were forced from their homes and land during the founding of the State of Israel. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital on 89.3 WPFW Pacifica Radio in the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Rivera, and we're going to go to a break now, and we'll be right back. Stay with us.
This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. It's about time we globalize the intifada. Listen close, I've got six words for Obama. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. It's about time we globalize the intifada. Listen close, I've got six words for Obama. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza.
The government supports the people of the UK, did it ism. The hijacked faith equals this. For this is the shame on Rothschild. Between them, the monster they created has gone wild.
احنا عدو انحصر من اخون غدر انتو بتشعروش بالبطولة لو حتفكم بحجر حجر الانسحاب من العراق مثل جراب فات جم خراب غياب فيش عقاب كم من تم كتم كم من ام هدم حريتي بتبدأ لما اخذها يدفع التمن سيد القاضي ينظر اليه افتح دينيه كم من دليل يصرخ عليه اترك المطرق اعطيني حرية
tears to laughter. Our children don't fear disaster, living near the master. Clear the fastest, hear the casket. We rap when we die from boom-bastic time. Looms after hot summer days in the thunder blaze. They murk your dreams like Theodore Herzl screams in the UN in 48. Third intifada for mother's daughters, sons martyred and empty fathers.
Like عودة وبس مجتمع كامل بالحبس. رصاص ضرب وضرب المطر كبس وكبس النفس ليك انقطع حتى الطفل انرفس. ست حدود ام حديد شيل الطير من القفص. روح طير طير يا عمي روح انت دمي حياتي وقلبي معك هيدا ذنبي. ناطر بس المهدي وعيسى أن يأتي والأمل الوحيد اللي صفى هو ربي.
با این که تو تلویزیون ها همش میشینن دروغ میگن داشتم اخبار میدیدم که چه زورا جورا رو بچه ها و عشقای مادر ها رو زمین میریزن. بچه ها شیرینن بهشون مشروب بچه ای که تازه یاد گرفته را بره و دستشو میگیرن پر کرد و تیریزن. کم وقت پیش صحنه های شبیه اینو تو چند قدمی میدیدم اه دارم چی میدم.
It's quite obvious what criminals use. Illegal weapons like white phosphorus burns your flesh to the bone. And if you happen to live, you'll be left infected with cancer. You curse the fact that you did. Forgive me if I wish the same fate on those Israelis responsible for killing all those innocent little babies. I studied the Torah and learned by their own admission Israel's actions are not culture in their own religion.
بطلع حوالي فيش حياة أخذوا أرضي من تحت شاي أعطوني معاناة كنا نحمل طرية نترزى من الله خلونا نحمل.
And welcome back to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital on 89.3 WPFW Pacifica Radio in the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Rivera. And my guest for the second half of the show is the economist, author, and commentator and president emerita of Bennett College, Julianne Malveau. Her latest book, Are We Better Off? Race, Obama, and Public Policy. In the book, Malveau is, one observer wrote, both compassionate and cutting, with both praise and protest about America's first black president, Barack Hussein Obama. Welcome back to the WPFW Airwaves and to this show, On the Ground, Julianne.
It's good to be with you, Esther. Thank you for having me.
So let's jump right in. You cover an amazing amount of ground in this book, from even before the massive historic inauguration, when I'm sure so many of us listening to this broadcast right now crammed onto the National Mall in the freezing cold.
Oh, gosh. I remember I had those football things, you know, the things you put
in your shoes
for football. Yeah. I had never heard of them before.
Right, right. So you cover so much from before that to today when there is so much, I think you use the term ambivalence.
Yes.
Toward the Obama legacy. So you ask in your book, Are We Better Off? And I don't think I'm spilling the beans by saying that you believe that we African Americans are not better off. But can you talk to us about how the ways we are not better off and how our condition can be traced to what President Obama has or has not done?
Great question. Well, first of all, we're not worse off either. That's the good news. So we could be worse off. I don't regret my votes for President Obama at all. I still consider myself a fan. I just think that he has not done what he could for our community. The closing line, I say, yes, we can. No, he didn't. You know,
right.
He had an opportunity to move us forward. He just didn't do it. Mm-hmm. Let's start with what was his fault. He had 2 years of a Democratic Congress and a Democratic Senate and a fair amount of wiggle room. And instead of using those 2 years to set the tableau for his legacy, he spent the 2 years pussyfooting around with people who didn't want to be his friend,
right.
Trying to make friends with people who didn't want to be his friend. Well, if someone, Mitch McConnell, says his number one priority is to make sure that you are our one-term president, you're looking at a time period where Unemployment rate is double digit for everybody, not just for black folks, where people are losing their houses by the tens of thousands. And your number one priority is to get rid of this president? Well, if somebody said that to me, believe me, I would not be trying to make friends with them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would simply say, okay, you sit in your corner and you stew in your evil juice and, you know, let me try to do some things because I have the votes.
Right.
But that unique opportunity to have the votes, he squandered it.
Right.
Secondly, I think that when we look at the recovery money, almost $800 billion that went into, you know, basically rebuilding our cities, rebuilding, employing. That money went to the states and not to the cities. The cities are blacker, browner, younger, older, more female than the overall population. Giving money to mayors would have made a huge difference in any number of things, including, guess what, the 2010 vote. See, what we ended up getting in 2010, the president then lost the Congress.
Right.
And so had more people felt like, we had unprecedented number of people come out to vote. And these were people, many of them were first-time voters, young people. And you know how, I'm not dissing young people, so millennials who are listening, don't call and say I dissed you. But some folks have a shorter time period satisfaction arc than others do. And they voted in 2008 and then in 2010, like, what has he done for me lately? Well, not much. But if the money had gone to cities, it might have. So when you look objectively at some of the numbers, I mean, essentially, there's more black child poverty now than there was when the president took over. Incomes have not moved significantly. That may change a little bit this year, but incomes have not moved. The unemployment rate gap remains the same. The rates, of course, have lowered for everybody. The home ownership challenge is a huge challenge. African Americans lost not only homes, but
half
also wealth.
Yeah.
You know, so we're looking at those kinds of things. Now, there are those who will say, and I have some sympathy with their or empathy with their position, they feel proud that the president is the president. I get a little sizzle when I see him sort of swag onto Air Force One. I mean, the symbolism is lovely, but then again, I can't eat symbolism, and neither can anybody else. You know, there are a lot of times when this president could just do black folk giveaways, which is not giving away dollars or anything, but even recognition. As an example, you know, April 12th was Equal Pay Day. It was the day that women had to work to earn as much as men earned the previous year.
Okay.
But Equal Pay Day for black women does not occur until August 1st. Hmm. Equal Pay Day for Latina women does not occur until November 1st. So while he gave a very great, I thought, speech about women and Equal Pay Day, and he dedicated the Sewell Belmont House, which is now, I think, going to be called the Belmont Paul National Memorial for the Women's Party. Mm-hmm. As you talk about Equal Pay Day, I mean, how much does it cost you to just throw it? And by the way, and black women will have to work another 3 months.
Right.
You know, those kind of things. I mean, he gives throwaways to us when he wants to be negative. For example, when he was at the University of Chicago and a woman challenged him and said, why did you pick Merrick Garland and not, you know, aren't you concerned about diversity? And his response, which I thought was entirely flippant and offensive, was, well, I guess I could have picked a black lesbian from Skokie. I thought that was like totally offensive.
You know, I have actually a clip of one of the other kind of scolding moments, you call them scolder in chief moments, when he spoke to the CBC. And I think we can play that.
So I don't know about you, CBC, but the future rewards those who press on. With patient and firm determination, I'm going to press on for jobs. I'm going to press on for equality. I'm going to press on for the sake of our children. I'm going to press on for the sake of all those families who are struggling right now. I don't have time to feel sorry for myself. I don't have time to complain. I'm going to press on. I expect all of you to march with me and press on. Take off your bedroom slippers. Put on your marching shoes. Shake it off. Stop complaining. Stop grumbling. Stop crying. We are going to press on. We've got work to do. CBC, God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
So that caused quite a stir.
I so did not appreciate that. I mean, I write about it a little bit. I so did not appreciate that. You have John Lewis, who was beaten upside his head marching.
Right.
In the crowd. You have Maxine Waters, Woman of Courage. Barbara Lee only wants to stand up with Lil Bush, you know, want to go to Iraq. Come on, sir. I mean, what is wrong with you? I mean, the bedroom shoes? I just found that. I found that so, again, just so insulting and so discordant. And he just has a tendency to talk to black people that way. He doesn't talk to anybody else like that.
Yeah, is this, and I think you have a chapter, like you said, about that. And it's like, is this any way to treat your people in the book? The book is Are We Better Off by Julian Malvo. And where do you think that this scolder-in-chief instinct came from? You know, even today, like the insult you just mentioned that just happened, he's still doing this. I mean, it comes from a really unfortunate place.
Well, first of all, I don't think that he's surrounded by the right people. I think that, you know, his intimate team are not people who are used to black people, quite frankly, or used to regular black people. No homies on his team. Because I think if he ran this by, and I don't even necessarily say homies, if he ran it by a now deceased but amazing political scientist, Ron Walters, he would say, no, man, you don't want to go in that direction.
Right.
If he ran it by me, I would say, yeah, I don't think this is such a good idea. If you look at some of the other people, I think even Melody Barnes might have said, I'm not so sure about that. But he runs this stuff by folks who basically are not used to our community. I think he's a little bit frustrated at some of the criticism that he gets from our community, but he doesn't get that frustrated when he gets criticism from other communities. But I really don't know. To me, there's some kind of a dysfunction.
So how do you think this impacts the current presidential race? It's very interesting to me because there are two things that have happened. Of course, Hillary Clinton has wrapped herself in the legacy of Obama. And at the same time, you have many people on the left who aren't necessarily thrilled with Obama's legacy. Not just in terms of these kinds of symbolic things and these kinds of statements, but on all kinds of policies. So how do you think that this is inserting itself into the election? The black community, despite all the controversies that the black left has raised, they're solidly voting for Hillary Clinton still in the race. So how has this legacy?
Well, it's really interesting. Hillary has been very canny in trying to wrap herself around Obama. And so Mr. Trump in particular has responded by calling it the Obama-Clinton administration. And certainly one of the weak, I basically talk about domestic public policy, just very little bit about foreign policy, but mostly about domestic public policy in my book. But I would say that most foreign policy experts look at this president's foreign policy legacy, quite frankly, as extremely weak.
Right.
I think that, you know, he got the Nobel for Peace in the Middle East in his first year before he'd done anything. And the Middle East is a bigger mess now than it was at the beginning. He, you know, has not been able to basically affect positive change there. And, you know, selling wolf tickets to Syria and everyone else. And then if you're going to sell them, then cash them. Well, I'd rather you not sell them because I believe in peace. But I mean, but don't sell a bunch of wolf tickets and make us look like, you know, we all bark and no bite. So when she wraps herself in that legacy as also former Secretary of State, she makes herself, I think, very vulnerable. When you look at the Affordable Care Act, on the other hand, which I consistently, and I think everybody sees that as a major Obama accomplishment. When you own that, and when you get a Bernie Sanders who says he doesn't like that, he would do something different, you know, then you get, it's very good for her because you get the sense of point counterpoint. I think that Bernie Sanders has done a huge, huge service to the Democratic Party by pushing Hillary to the left, by making her think. I think that had we had a coronation, which is what people were hoping for a year ago.
And working for. I mean, I think the DNC had everything lined up for her.
They had it planned. They weren't going to have so many debates. You had these tepid white men, Martin O'Malley, who's the other guy? But, you know, these tepid people who you wouldn't remember. you know, on the, you know, running. And then here comes Bernie with this, you know, burst of energy and enthusiasm. So he's done her an extreme favor. At the same time, what Bernie lacks, in my opinion, is a sense of pragmatism. And that's what Hillary has. And so I think at the end of the day, what you see when she says she embraces the Affordable Care Act and she wants to expand it, but he says, no, I want to do something totally else. Policy wonks. Now, this isn't, you know, man on the street, but policy wonks are sitting there saying, you know, she makes more sense. Because right. You can't get anything done, of course, unless you have the votes. And so, I mean, as it is, the Republicans keep trying to chop up the Affordable Care Act. They have not been successful, but they keep trying, and they're not going to stop trying. So for her, her approach is far more
kind of understandable for a lot of people who remember how contentious that debate was. But at the same time, I guess a lot of people on the left remember that single payer was taken off the table. It wasn't even allowed to be on the table.
Right.
And so there are people still smarting from that. And Bernie Sanders is going back to that same constituency saying that this is what we should have had from the start. And we weren't even allowed to sit down at the table with single payer.
So. And the challenge there, of course, is, again, had the president been able to use both the influence of Senator Kennedy, who, of course, untimely passed as the Affordable Care Act was working its way through. But also, had he been able to get this done, you know, when he had both houses of Congress, I think that single payer could have been something discussed. But I think once you got it, you know, remember, he had to get Republican votes and they weren't hearing it. And I think that single payer to them is like synonymous with what, communism or socialism or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so there are pragmatic considerations that, mm-hmm. that have to be taken into consideration, you know, kept in mind.
So this is also kind of related to the presidential race, but not. But I'm wondering if you think there's a generational divide or somewhat a class divide in the perception of what Obama has done and what he hasn't done. And I say this because in the presidential race, there's developed a generational divide, even in terms of who people are supporting in the African-American community, more young African-Americans. And they even said up to into the 40s are supporting Bernie Sanders. And a lot of this has to do, I think, with not only the issue of student debt, but also the fact that there are more people who are older who saw benefits under that last Clinton administration, people who saw themselves do better in the 90s, and maybe not looking at the economics in a very sophisticated way, but saying, I did well in the 90s, right now I'm not doing well, so I'm going to support this person. And young people saying, well, I don't have that memory, I don't have that history of doing well, then all I've seen is war and recession, you know, in my adult life.
You know, there is a great generational divide overall, and certainly among African Americans as well. Far more openness to Senator Sanders among young African Americans than among older African Americans. And the line seems to be about age 45, so it's not just the millennials. But there are others who are really saying and really feeling that what they got from the Clinton legacy was the crime bill. I mean, and they will go back and look at the crime bill, and that's what they'll remember. They won't remember the economic expansion. They won't remember, what the positivity that occurred. And so, and you see it among women as well. It's very fascinating when you see it play out among women, especially because so many women of my generation, so many baby boomers, bonded at some level with the Clintons. It was a good time. I mean, Bill and Hillary Clinton, I mean, I wrote a piece called Had Hillary Heart Burning, and I have endorsed nobody. Let me be clear, nobody. Because on my Facebook page, we constantly have these conversations. Folks say, well, you know you're supporting Clinton. No, I know that my friends are. And I will support the Democrat. Whichever Democrat wins, I'm going to work real hard for him. But I like Bernie Sanders' ideas. I don't find many of them practical. I don't find, when he says free college tuition, tell me how you're going to pay for it. You know, I need to know how you're going to pay for it. Now, some of my economist friends are working with him, younger folks, and they're like, go on his webpage, spend us a day on his webpage. And so maybe I'll do that. But I think that, you know, the whole notion of a plantation, and people see a lot of older black folks as living on the Clinton plantation. Well, you know, for some folks, it's not a plantation, but it was a place where they remember having had good things occur, where businesses grew and expanded. We're not going to be able to say that about black business under Obama. Indeed, the Great Recession wiped off out half of our black auto dealerships. So, the generational divide is real, but we're going to continue to see this. I think part of the challenge is that young people have tended not to party identify. They've tended to identify themselves as independents. And it suggests to me that our two-party system, as it does about every 100 years or so, is fraying. That right. Democrat and Republican doesn't really capture everything we want to say. But we are, constitutionally, we're a two-party system. We don't have four parties. We don't have proportional voting. Those are things I think that could improve things. And we have this year and a half campaign cycle, which really needs to be truncated. And yeah, again, the question is always, how do you get to that kind of political reform? I mean, when you look at the billions of dollars, Esther, the billions of dollars that are spent on these campaigns, how many people could you feed? How many jobs could you create? How many schools could you repair?
Well, I don't really look at the campaigns that way. I look at the wars that way.
Well, I look at the wars that way too.
Trillions, and
No! I look at the wars that way too. I look at everything that way. But in terms of the campaigns, I just find it just very wasteful.
Yeah. So we actually only have a couple minutes left. So I wanted to give you a chance to say what the best thing, you know, what is the best thing that Obama's done and what's the worst thing he's done? You know, he could have done more about mass incarceration, pardons, clemency. These are things that you mentioned, you know, in the book and issues after the 2012 reelection, you know, sequestration, poverty, state and local elections. You really kind of get into it very in-depth in a very, very comprehensive way in your book. But if you can shorthand it for us, the best and the worst.
Well, the best thing is health care. Mm-hmm. The best thing is the Affordable Care Act. Since President Roosevelt, this is the first time we've seen the social safety net expand. That is a real accomplishment. People have been talking about health care. As you know, Senator Kennedy, it was his pet project. Secretary Clinton, when she came in as First Lady in 1993, she attempted to put together a task force to deal with it. And then they said the task force was unconstitutional because she wasn't an elected official and blah, blah. So this is a real accomplishment. Whether the bill is perfect or not, and it isn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination. You know, it certainly gives us a basis from which to grow in terms of what people are entitled to. People are entitled to affordable health care. The worst thing.
But isn't that really tied to the insurance system? And isn't what Bernie Sanders saying is that we don't need this middle person insurance. We don't need insurance. We need health care.
That's what he's saying. And I agree. I mean, I agree with you. But as I say, I think this is it's a step in the right direction. It's a step that we didn't have before. So it is a move in the right direction. When you look at the number of people who now have increased access, I mean, that's important. There are people who had no access before. They've included some things like dental, which is really important for our young people. I mean, I think mental and dental health are the things that most often get excluded. So, you know, I think it's one of the best things he's done. I'll put it that way. I give him credit for that. Maybe, and the other good thing he did was appointed Eric Holder, I think that was very, courageous and brilliant. And Eric Holder, we miss him, although Loretta Lynch is great as well. The worst. Well, there's just so many there. You know, and again, I'm not a hater. I'm just saying, just looking at it objectively. I think in terms of African American people, the worst is the way that he ignored this community. The Congressional Black Caucus was the last congressional caucus that he met with. He's nodded and bowed to other communities. He bathed the White House in rainbow colors when marriage equality passed the Supreme Court. He celebrated with immigration reform, although it's certainly not what it should be. But there has been no nod. The Institute for the Black World's Commission on Reparations has asked him simply to appoint a John Hope Franklin Commission on Reparations. Didn't say give us reparations, appoint a commission to study this. John Conyers has introduced legislation annually since 1986. Of course, you can't get the vote. So these are some of the symbolic kind of things he's done. Now, symbolically, give you
Did he endorse this?
No.
Well, see, that was your aha moment, you said in the book.
Yeah, when way
you,
back when.
Way
yeah.
back when, but yeah. when he was actually running for Senate, when you interviewed him, and he, said, he wouldn't talk about, that's when the cameras got turned off. Like, yes. when you asked him about reparations, and he said something that wouldn't be helpful or something. So, that made me think that, you know, that section of the book made me think that, you know, this is really a very packaged corporate politician. And isn't Hillary the same? And more so with the Clinton Foundation, wealthy donors, Wall Street and corporations. I just think that people are just tired of it. I just think that.
Well, I think, you know what? I think I think that one of the things that I have to keep reminding myself about President Obama is a thing a friend of mine always says. He said, you have to inspect your expectations.
Okay.
So what were my expectations? As you say, it's center left, basic center left. I think we might have been slightly better off had Hillary been elected in 8. And that if she had been elected in 8 and he had come in 16, I think it would be a very different kind of situation. And she may have set up the tableau for some things that African-American people then could run with. But okay. I think that at the moment, you know, I assume he did his best. What I tell people about my book is the best part to read, well, the whole book. Of course, I'm narcissistic, so, and I admit that. So, you know, I think it's a great book. But the end of the book, where I talk about 2016 and beyond, really asks questions that we want to ask any candidate. Okay. That we want to, and I think that is one of the best takeaways. I mean, a lot of takeaways, but that's a good takeaway, is just to look at what should you ask anybody? Hillary, Bernie, Trump, although he won't answer. Cruz, although he doesn't know. But anyway, ask okay. any of them.
Okay. Well, I've been speaking to economist, author, and commentator Julianne Malveaux. Her latest book is Are We Better Off? Race, Obama, and Public Policy. Thank you for being on the ground with us today, Julianne.
Thank you.
And that will do it for us on the Ground. Thanks again to Julianne Malveaux, Mariam Fatala, and Amina Ashkar of the NACWA Tour. Thanks to our engineer, Mike Nasella, and thank you so much for listening. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. Please don't forget to like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for a special I Mix What I Like Music Colony tribute to Prince with DJ RBI and I Mix What I Like team. Until next week, raise your voice out there. Peace.